Answorth Reel 6.
We established another observation point for collecting information, you see, on this slope. And then on the far side, we saw some infantry transport come up, you see. There was a lieutenant quartermaster there. He sent across to us after a time. And I went over, and they said, are we off for grub, you see? So I said, well, I've only got biscuits and bully. And so I said, you got a bag. He gave us some bread and, butter and rationed that and jam and such as that and tea and sugar. And, you know, he's a chap asking he'd be getting on to 50, a lieutenant quartermaster, so he's not a fighting man at all. He'd brought up all the rations. And he was practically in tears. He said his lad wouldn't need it. You see, the thing is, when you lose men, it's a day or two before you can stop the rations coming up. You have a ration strength of so many, and the Army Service Corps in the back, they're setting up that, you see. Even, well, you might have lost half of your men. And what happens to all the group? You live like fighting cocks, so just left for a day or two. Well, then another point I saw was this plane, a Marane Saunier, it's a French plane that we had at the time, monoplane, kept diving down onto the corner of a field, you know, on our left front. I saw this cavalry coming across. I found out after the Indians, the Deccan Horse, they called them. And this plane was diving down like that, you see, and up again, you see. And suddenly, the officer in charge of the cavalry, he cottoned on. And he stood up in his stirrups, waved his sword above his head, and they just charged like that across that field. The two outer lots split like that, you see, sort of encircled. Next thing we saw, there's 34 Jerry Prisms, some of those heavy machine guns. They're waiting while the cavalry got a bit near. By God, they just slaughtered them. But just like that, it just went like that. Like the shot out of God, bats out of hell.
This was British cavalry?
Indians. Indian cavalry, yes. The Deccan Horse. Deccan is it's a part of India, isn't it? The Deccan Plain, you see, province of that. But I never seen it like it in my life.
So this was a successful cavalry charge captured some machine guns?
Yes. Well, it had to do, otherwise they'd all been killed. But, I mean, the plane was, I think, trying to draw their attention to the fact that the... Because he couldn't do anything. He's no arms, you see. Just diving down on top. I suppose distracting these machine gunners, because a plane coming down, you know, close above your head is enough to draw their attention. And as I say, this fella cottoned on and he just stood up in his shirt, waved his sword out, and it went like that and encircled them. It was all over in a matter of seconds.
That must have been a pretty rare sight on the Western Front.
Then they saw I saw some Jerry prisoners coming back, and this was really terrible, really. There was about 200 of them, you see, and there was, I think, a score of our chaps, guards, you know, down the side and in front. There's a big German officer leading in front, proper square he was, about 6'2" or 6'3", and he's walking behind this corporal who's leading, and he suddenly grabs his rifle from behind, he slopped down, like that, turned around, I don't know what he held, he was too far away, so he shouted, shouting, you see, to his men. Instantly, all these, our chaps, they just ran about 50 yards away and turned around and started shooting at him. I'm going to pretty soon quell that mutiny. But, I mean, a stupid thing to do, really. They were all disarmed.
Okay.
Well, then we got back to the battery. Well, the officer, he's sent down when he does get back for, you know, for ostensibly a course somewhere. He's suffering from, I mean, he always was an excitable, nervous sort. He got into trouble in the race course. I mean, for his horse wouldn't stand still or something, and he kicked it in the belly. By God, imagine. It'd have killed him. Mm. You never will treat a horse. That's one of the things they have. They never allow you to do it. They'll treat a horse.
What happened to you after this?
Well, as I say,
this is where you got wounded.
A day or two later, we went up in the evening to get another observation post. You see, because where we were was out of range. Mr. Noble and Mr. Robbins, myself, went up, and we got through beyond Montauban, and then there's Bernafay Wood on your right front, and we went to Trone's Wood. Well, good God, there was no trees intact at all. There were just stumps about this height, and tree tops all mixed up together. There was barbed wire up to that height, bodies all over the place, cherries and ours. And Robbins, he pulled some undergrowth about. We were having to fish our way through this, you see. And there was a dead Jerry there, where he was shot away right up his hip like that, and all his guts hanging out and flies on it, you see. And he just had a step back, and this leg that was up in the tree branch above him, that leg fell across him on his head. Good Lord, he vomited on the spot. Terrible. So we came out of there, not having opinion, and that was in the corner there. We saw this concrete emplacement, and that's where he's been observing them when we got buried, you see. It's completely open ground to there. And every time we stuck a flag up, he started shooting at us with these 4.2s. So we got out of that. We're walking across this open ground between Bernafay Wood and Trones Wood, and there's a big trench goes right across it, big communication trench. And Mr. Robin and Mr. Nobbins, they'd got across there, and I'd stopped to cut some brass buttons off a dead man's tunic, and he won't want them anymore, of his coat. We were getting by then these composition buttons, not plastic, there wasn't plastic, just some sort of compo, compressed, and the shank pulled out of them. But awful things. Good brass buttons, I'd love those, and I cut them off, and I've just got these buttons in my pocket, and I heard it, Jerry was harassing fire, you know, odd ones dropping about with 5.9s, you see. And I thought, this one's coming close. Well, before I did it, you always mark your cover, you see, the nearest hole to dive into. And so I dived for this trench, you see, and flung myself into that. As I flung myself over, there's bodies laid on the fire step. So I land in the bottom of the trench on my haunches, you see. And at that moment, this blubbing shell lands in the corner of the trench. I'd have been better if I'd have stayed on top. Well, the blast blew me out of that trench. I was just getting to my feet, you know, as you go down the it blew me out of that trench. I bruised my hip on the edge of the trench as I fell out, I think. And I landed about, you know, 2 or 3 bays away. Well, they'd both dropped at these two officers in front. And I picked myself up. Oh, boy, there's this huge cloud of smoke. Oh, boy, hell, that's bloody lucky. And I started, I said, are you all right? I said, yes. And so I started to walk on after them. No bones broken. In riding school, they taught you to fall soft, you see, and instinctively you do it. Let everything go slack. And so I walked on a bit, and I felt this hand was wet. So I wiped it on my breeches. And I wiped it a second time on my breeches. No, God, it's blazing sun, everything's dry as a bone. There was blood running off my hands. So I thought, oh, well, went in there and came out here. So I said, just shouted to him. I said, half a more, I am it after all. So we sat down in a hall. I'd got a field dressing. You used to have a field dressing in the corner of your tunic, you see. Well, being a precautious type, I had two, one in each corner. And they hadn't one. Neither of them. So I got one out, and he started bound up round it. I says, I'm all right. He says, that's my arm. I said, no, it's here. I didn't know then. I'd got one in here through my jaw, maybe a faint scar, is there? I think you see, very faint. Mm. And one in the throat here, just Mr. Dougley, we were 8th and 8th. Another one in the back, which I didn't find out that till I got to the one about the one in the back, you know. I'd stopped 4 pieces, and I never felt him. You feel it afterwards, mind you. But just at the moment, you didn't feel anything at all.
Now, after you were wounded, what sort of treatment did you get in France?
Well, first of all, the two officers took me to an advanced field post, a dressing station, in Bernafay Wood.
Yeah?
And I was sort of re-bandaged there, you see. And while we were there, there was a man brought in on a... They tied him down with a wire on a stretcher, got shell shock. God, he was raving mad. But then, when it got dark, from there, I was put into a horse ambulance, a pair of horses, sort of a covered wagon sort of thing it was, with two stretchers at the bottom and two stretchers at the top. And I was in one of the upper stretchers. And from that point, we had to cross what had been no man's land for 22 months. Well, the road was in a hell of a state, and this thing was lurching all over the place. And before long, myself and the other lad on the top stretcher, we were thrown into the floor. There was nothing we could do about it. There was only one chap, nobody inside, only the driver up front. He got us to Billon Wood. And from there, we were unloaded and put onto a motor ambulance. And it was a Siddeley Deasy. I remember that, with the radiator where the Renaults used to be, just in front of the dash, behind the bonnet. And there was no room inside, so I was put on the front with a blanket round me, and the driver was told to hold on to me so I didn't fall out. From that point, we were taken down to, this is still during the night, we were taken down to Dives Copse. And that was a big marquee. And we were just laid on the grass there, not even on stretchers, just laid on the bare grass. And they gave us an injection for tetanus, I think, in the chest. And then we're left to nobody at all. Well, I wanted to piss like hell, and so I crawled out of there on my elbow and my knees, and I laid on my side. I had a pee in the grass outside and crawled back again. Well, in the morning, some of the old Tin Lizzie ambulances came, the ancient T-model Fords with 3.5-inch rear tyres and 3-inch fronts and transverse springs, which were useless. That took us down to Corby, and we were taken to a school there and laid on the bare boards. Nobody came near us. This was in the, I think, maybe 10 o'clock in the morning we got there, and nobody came near us all day. Nothing was done whatever. I had some secret codes with, you know, that I crawled to the fireplace and put a match to those and burnt them. And then in the evening we were taken to the station and loaded onto a train for Rouen. And that was the first time we saw any nurses. All this guff about nurses in the battle front, I mean, that was just rubbish. We got to Rouen, and the first thing was we were undressed. And I felt rather embarrassed with this girl undressing me. She used the towel, you know, discreetly. And as she's pulling my shirt up at the back, there's a sudden sharp stab of pain, and I just said sort of ouch like that, you know, and she says, what's the matter? So I said, she was smoking a cigarette, and I said, I've dropped some ash. And she said, I haven't. And when she pulled my shirt up, she said, there was another wound in the back. She said, there was a piece of shell there, a shell splinter. And she says, oh, here's the culprit, and she threw it in the grass. So bang went my souvenir. And however, Dr. McNeil was the man's name who came round and examined us, and he said to me, no need to worry, laddie. I thought I got lockjaw, because my jaw by then was locked up tight. And he says, you've not got lockjaw. He says, you've got a piece of dirty German iron wedged in the hinges.
In the hinges of your jaw?
Yes, that's what he said. And so in the morning, we were unloading, putting onto buses, the old London buses, and taken down to the quayside in Rouen. And put aboard the St. Andrew, which was...
Who were the drivers of the buses? Civilians or military?
Oh, no, military. Yeah. Military.
Before we go over to England on the boat, could you tell me a bit more about the dressing station that you went to first of all? Where was it set up, and how big was it?
At Bernafair Wood?
Yeah.
Well, it was only sort of dug into a bank, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Describe what you can remember about it.
Nothing much, because they evacuated them as quickly as they could. You see, they only went in there to have the dressings put on, that's all. There was nobody stayed there. Mm. The ambulances were coming up and taking them away.
Yeah.
They were merely to sort of give a man, I suppose, a preliminary dressing to stop bleeding and that sort of thing. Mm. They didn't give you any actual treatment.
Yeah.
Not as far as I could see.
And the other places you went to in France, you mentioned the school and you mentioned Rouen. Mm. Were either of these major hospitals?
No. The school was nothing. Just there's no nurses, nobody there at all.
Mm.
It was just a place to store you until they could move you on.
What about Rouen? Was that set up for...
Well, that was a hospital, yes.
Yeah.
In Marquise.
Yes.
Mm.
Can you remember much about that hospital? How big it was?
I was only there, one night in the morning, that's all.
Yeah.
No, I was in the Marquise all the time. I've no idea. No. Mm.
There were military...
It was a Scottish, second Scottish something hospital, I believe. And I know this doctor who attended me, his name was Captain McNeil. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so after Rouen, they loaded you on a boat.
I got on the St. Andrew. A beautiful sunny day, and we were all sat about. Well, of course, the bad cases, they were taken down below, you see. And there was a colonel, RMC, came up, and you all had a tag on your tunic, you see. And he looked at this tag, and he yelled for one of the NCOs, had me bunged down below quick. I didn't want to go down, I wanted to stop on deck. But went down below onto, I suppose, presume it would be the saloon deck. And the starboard side was... they're made of bunks, three tiers, one at floor level, you see, one halfway and one just below the upper deck, you see. And I was in the top one. And on the port side, there were tables with a combing, it's like a ledge around the edge, you know, so that the plates and things didn't fall off. We went down the river, and by dinner time, we were out into the channel, you see. And through the porthole, which was open, I saw one of those five-masted Scandinavian full-rig ships, you know. And heeling over, I said, and in the sun, it was one of the most wonderful sights I've ever seen in my life. Mm. And I said, she was really moving too. So the ship was just rolling gently, like that, you know, and they started bringing the usual stew for the chaps, you see. So seven men on either side of this table and one man at the head serving, you see. They passed the plates down either side, and I could see the ship rolling was more and more as we got into further out into the channel, until I could see the wave as she dipped. I could, from my position in the top, I could see the wave just a few inches below the porthole, and I was just going to shout and warn them, and the next wave came clean through that porthole, a solid jet of water, and dropped plonk onto that table, and the plates just went like that, upended, and deposited the stew in the laps of each man, you see. So, the man at the head of the table, brave man, jumped on the table to shut the porthole.
Yeah.
Just in time to catch the next one solidly in the chest, which knocked him backwards, clean off the end of the table into the floor. Then one of the crew came up and got it at it from the side and shut it, you see. All went well after that. But I thought it was rather amusing at the time, although the fellows who suffered didn't. They were all wet through. Mm. And so we got to England eventually, and at Southampton, we were loaded into on a train, and we walking cases were put into ordinary corridor coaches, and each compartment had been filled up with sort of straw and mattresses and things, you see, so that we could lay right across the seats, four men in each compartment. And there were girls coming in down the corridor changing our French money into English money. Those who hadn't changed them aboard the ship, but aboard the ship we wouldn't do it, because they were only giving you about sevenpence for a franc, you know. And they were making money very, very nicely to the RAMC. So, however, we got to Birmingham eventually, to New Street, and we had to change engines there, I think. And while we stood in this platform, because there was a huge crowd on the waiting to see them. At Birmingham, yes. Mm. This was the first successful offensive, you see, and there was hundreds of people on the platform, and one of the chaps in my compartment, a chap called Bill Neat,